You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet the director of a new documentary on cuts to higher education in Wisconsin and around the country.
Now, a report released yesterday by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families found that while child gun deaths are falling across the country, they're still on the rise here in Wisconsin.
According to the report, over a four-year period ending in 2014, the rate of kids killed by guns in Wisconsin went up by 31%. In that same period, the national rate of child gun deaths fell by about 7%.
Here to tell us more about the report's findings is Dipesh Nafsaria, assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Nafsaria, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, 31%, that sounds like a big jump. So how alarming is this for people who work in public health and pediatrics?
Well, it does sound like a big jump, although we do need to remember that a small difference in terms of a couple of deaths here and there additionally could cause those percentages to look much different. The thing is, of course, is that we're talking about children. We're talking about children that really there's no need for them to die. A lot of these deaths are through accidents. They're through unintentional injuries, bystanders, things of that nature. So it is concerning when we see these things increasing because, in theory, these deaths should be preventable.
You mentioned accidents and injuries. Are we also including things like homicides or suicides in this number?
In the total number, we are including that because this report is about gun deaths in children, period, irrespective of the intent. However, it's hard to get really good data sometimes about homicide because some deaths are actually coded as homicides, whether the shooter intentionally pulled the trigger, or whether they, versus whether they actually intended to harm the child in question. So some of these could be accidents. It's not really clear in terms of the classification by authorities. But the point being that, guns are dangerous, right? Their intent is to harm or to kill someone. So when a child is in the vicinity or a child is handling the gun or so on, we know that there's these higher risks of these children being injured or killed in some manner.
Now, this climb comes after a record low. What do you think about that turnaround? What do you make of it?
We're not really sure. That's the thing. There's a lot of different factors that go into this. So why is there this recent increase? If you look at national trends, the number of kids killed by guns has plateaued after several years of decreases. So is this that this lack of recent progress towards reducing the number of child deaths is just a nationwide problem and we're just seeing in Wisconsin happens to be increasing? We're not sure. We also know that the rate of adults killed with guns has risen over the last several years, both in our state as well as in other states.
I want to talk more specifically about who this is affecting. Now, obviously, this is not a number you ever want to see go up, ever, but looking at the data, which children are most affected by this?
Well, the ones that seem to be disproportionately much more affected are African-American children, and it's just very startling if you end up looking at the report, the graph just really stands out at you, that if you look at per 100,000 children in Wisconsin, white non-Hispanic children, it's just 1.4. And again, that's not to say that any number above zero shouldn't be acceptable. These are still children, But if you look at African-American children, that number surges up to 6.4. So there's a huge disparity there in that group. And if you look geographically, even per 100,000 children, there's significantly more in Milwaukee County, but also Dane County and the counties around Green Bay.
And is there a particular age group that's affected, or is this something we're just seeing across the spectrum from 0 to 18?
Most of the victims, as you might surmise, are adolescents. 16 to 17 is much higher than even 10 to 15. And again, that probably has to do with risk factors, with involvement in various activities that may be more likely to have firearm involvement. But it's not zero for the kids in the 0 to 9 age group, that there's 15 in the 0 to 4 group and 14 in the 5 to 9 group. In the time period we're looking at.
We're talking right now with Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria. He is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're talking about a new report finding that child gun deaths in Wisconsin have gone up despite being in a decline nationwide. And Looking at Milwaukee County as one source of where these gun deaths are happening, what in particular strikes you about this number being higher in Milwaukee?
Well, it's hard to know. We know that concentrated poverty tends to have much higher rates of crime and violence. And kids in those neighborhoods, you know, they're less likely to have high-quality schools. They're less likely to have safe places for them to play, you know, outside and things like that. So some of this can be bystander violence. It can be all the things that come along with poverty make it more likely that that they're to be killed by guns. I don't think we know for sure why those differences are there. What we do know is that we have a profound lack of data and information nationally about what would make guns safer, what would make owning a gun safer, because there's actually federal restrictions. There's this, the law prevents the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from actually putting any money or resources into researching this. So we actually don't have any good data on what sorts of interventions would make a difference.
And I know that's one of the action plans that advocates are looking at, directing the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to conduct research on the best ways to keep children and others safe from guns. So given this lack of information, what do we have to go on?
Well, you know, there's things that people are looking at, like smart gun technology and so on. But since, you know, that's still being evolving, and, you know, and we need, there needs to be significant consumer demand in order for manufacturers to actually manufacture weapons that have those safety features that would protect children. What we do is, in pediatrics, we encourage safe storage. We advise families that they should, if they choose to own a gun in their home for whatever reason, then they should keep their gun locked up with the ammunition unloaded and in a separate box, because to be able to defeat that number of things, you know, to unlock two boxes and to load the gun, et cetera, is much harder for a curious toddler. It's much harder for a younger child, and it's much harder for, say, a suicidal teen to be able to impulsively or whatever do something that is potentially fatal. And that's important, because in only 4 out of 10 homes, based on the studies that we do have, did owners actually store guns in that way. In 3 out of 10 homes, it was unlocked, but they still was unloaded, et cetera. And in 10% of homes, it's unlocked and loaded guns that any child could wander into and just play with and not know. And education doesn't actually make a difference with young children. This great study showing that even children who had been through gun safety training classes, when they were in an experimental situation where what looked like a real gun was in the vicinity, et cetera, many of them touched it, you know, and picked it up and handled it despite having just gone through safety training. Children are developmentally different. They don't understand the risks. They don't understand it as well as someone who's older. So we need to take that into account and make sure that we don't have something have fatal consequences.
Now, you're a physician. In your experience, is this kind of conversation difficult to have with parents? And guns can be a touchy subject, no matter how you slice it. But is it also something that you found to be effective?
In my experience, it's been very effective. I think, you know, all parents want the best for their children. They want their children to be safe. And I'm not talking at all about don't have a gun, don't do this, anything like that. What I'm saying is, if you have something that is a potential risk to your child, I want you to learn how to effectively and safely be able to prevent them from harm. We have the same conversation about swimming pools. If someone tells me they have a swimming pool, I tell them, all right, is there a complete fence and gate around it? And do you have your child monitored? And do you have it covered over when, you know, and make sure that you don't have a kid drowning in it? You know, we go through all this stuff, and we do this for all sorts of things. We do it for medications. This is part of what we do, and this is what parents want us to do. They want us to give them advice on how to keep their children safe from unintentional harm, injury, and those sorts of things.
And you also mentioned gun design, maybe in the way that would make guns more difficult to operate, and some sort of smart gun design, I know, has run into opposition. It's been politically sensitive. How do you imagine navigating that kind of debate?
You know, I don't know that I could really say much on that right now, because I think that the technology is probably not as mature as it should be, and we don't have any data. If smart gun technology that they thought was feasible could come out, and we could actually see, do some trials, you know, how much does this prevent a child or an unintentional user from using these guns, then we might actually have some data. You know, we do so much in healthcare that we try to base on evidence. When we have no evidence, we're having to use best common sense, et cetera. But I would really like to be able to give evidence-based recommendations to families the same way we do around all sorts of other things. I mean, for crying out loud, we're trying to look at the evidence on screen time, you know, and things like that and what that does to the brain and so on. We want to use evidence because we don't want to just say, well, we kind of made up this answer. But we have too many kids that are being harmed by guns and unintentionally. So what can we do to reduce the number of gun deaths? You're absolutely right that these are controversial, sensitive, highly politicized and charged topics. But I think the one thing that all of us, everyone in the state, should be able to agree on is that we should be able to agree that every child in our state deserves to not be injured or killed by a gun.
Dr. Navzaria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Dipesh Navzaria, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked with us about a new report that found that child gun deaths in Wisconsin have gone up despite being on the decline nationwide. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new documentary looks at higher education cuts and makes the case that Wisconsin is part of a national effort to steer universities in a new direction. We'll meet the creator of the film.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. In Ozaukee and Sheboygan County, 7 bookmobiles make stops in small towns and rural areas, loaded with about 4,500 rotating books and media. It's the Eastern Shores Library System Bookmobile. Producer Nancy Camden went along for a ride.
Libraries are quiet places, but this is about a noisy library that runs on diesel. Everything inside, the lights, the heat, the computers, are powered with a generator.
We've got our passenger aboard, so I guess we're ready to go. My name is Sue Potter. I'm the bookmobile librarian. I've been driving it since November 17th, 1987.
My name is Lisa Hartman. I'm also a bookmobile librarian. The first day I drove, I think my top speed was like 25. Country roads are really skinny, so when you're driving this big thing down a country road and you see a car, it's a little panicky.
So you are back here in the back taking the books that are coming in.
I am checking them in, then rerouting them to the libraries they need to go to, or keeping them for our collection.
Adult things are near the top half of the vehicle, so adults don't have to bend, and the children's materials are at the bottom half.
I get lots of books here. I get fun books, and I also get books for school here.
Carol Fredericks, and this is my daughter Lily, and we live in Belgium. We homeschool. The bookmobile, it's a fantastic library. It's more than a library, it's a community. You can meet your neighbors.
We are always open to the public, no matter where we stop, whether it's an assisted living, a school, or a daycare. Everyone is welcome.
My name is Jackie Melchamer, and they live at Belgium Gardens. I have to wait till they bring them in. I have MS. I can't walk. We don't get to the library, so we have to get what comes to us. We're glad that it comes. I like mostly comedies, you know.
My name is Elizabeth Carls. I live in the town of Farmington, Fredonia, one of those out in the country places, which makes the bookmobile excellent for your rural areas. I don't have the internet. If you have really slow internet or no internet, the bookmobile, they are online. Now I'll ask Sue a question. She'll look it up right here.
My name is Wes Block. We are in the village of Wabaca. Bookmobile is full of people right now.
How old are you?
83.
Why is it you use the bookmobile?
It's convenient, and the ladies are very nice, usually.
This is our longest day on the road. Today, our day doesn't end until 6:20 tonight.
How many books go out of the bookmobile in an average day?
Today in Ozaukee County is probably 1,000. If we go over a big bump, the books in the back will jump up. And I did take a corner once a little too fast, and some flew out the door. But a very nice man on a motorcycle helped us.
It's Clifford, the big red dog.
What did you get?
A tractor book.
I got this kind of book.
If I had access to a bookmobile when I was young, it would have been wonderful.
Do you like the bookmobile?
Yes! Library on wheels.
Well, happy reading, everybody.
You too.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Buckled up for the next stop.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Now, Wisconsin's latest budget included major cuts to the UW system, and the Board of Regents just approved changes to tenure as required by that budget.
Our next guest says Wisconsin is not alone, that other states are seeing major budget cuts and controversies, and he says it's no accident. It's part of a conservative-led movement to cut funding and overhaul public universities.
He tells that story in a new documentary called Starving the Beast, the battle to disrupt and reform America's public universities. It screens next week, Wednesday and Thursday at the Wisconsin Film Festival. You can find schedule information at the Wisconsin Film Festival website.
Steve Mims joins us now. He's the writer and director of the documentary Starving the Beast. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Steve, you talked to Democratic political consultant James Carville in this documentary, and here he is talking about Wisconsin specifically.
Look at the University of Wisconsin. I mean, this is like one of the prime land-grant public universities in the United States. They're trying to rip that place completely apart.
Now, we've heard a lot about our UW system here in Wisconsin, but the story you're telling in this movie and that James Carville is part of here, seeing this as a national trend, this is not just Wisconsin. What do you see going on nationwide?
Well, when we started the film, we were following a story that was here. I live in Austin, Texas, and we were following what was happening at the University of Texas. And that involved the potential impeachment of a guy from the Board of Regents. And in covering that story, we moved on to Texas A&M, which had already had problems, and that led us to Wisconsin and everybody else. And it turns out that what we found in the research is that funding for public universities has radically declined over a 35-year period. And that since that's happened, the cost of education has been shifted over to students and to their families, or rather than being paid for by the state or underwritten so much by the state, and that had happened everywhere, and that a reform movement was underway at all these schools, including Wisconsin. And so there were these moves made to somehow find different sources of funding and to change the nature of public universities in general.
Is this a conscious effort, do you think, at the national level to change the mission, the funding process, all of that for American universities?
That's what we found, yeah, that there are groups, they're mostly coordinated through market-oriented think tanks, starting in Washington, D.C., but basically networked throughout the country. And it's purely a philosophical issue. Like the original idea for public education, public higher ed, was that the states would put a lot of money into public higher ed because the people who got a great degree would turn around and put that money back into the state. And that was the ideal for a long time. It still is, but there are a lot of people now who view it totally differently. And they think that they have a market-oriented view, and they think that if you walk out of a place like UW-Madison with a degree that has a market value, that you should shoulder a lot more of the cost of getting that degree because you're going to make more money over a lifetime. So there are people on both sides of this issue who are, you know, basically believe in that idea or in the other idea.
Well, you focused in on the mission of the university here in Wisconsin. Here's a bit from the documentary, UW-Madison Professor Grant Petty from the Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences Department talking about a change to the UW mission originally written into the state's most recent budget proposal.
The very fact that there was an impulse to remove that statement from the statute was a philosophical shift that was a very sharp break with the history of the university from being about the search for truth, about being an idea factory for civilization, to simply preparing students to join the workforce. It's a much narrower view of the mission of the university than most of us who work here would like to accept.
Do you see this change in mission happening at universities around the country, changing that, what you said was the historical, original mission of universities?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It There are, it's one of the amazing things in the film, I think, is because we have people who are very articulate about this, and there's a concern not only with the financial aspects of this, like to reduce the burden of taxpayers to have to pay for these institutions. Beyond that, there's another concern about really the ideas that people get exposed to in universities. And so that falls right in line with, like, are we making an institution that helps people? I try to be very careful about this because I don't want to sound slanted one way or the other, because there's a legitimate way to look at this from both sides. But there's a way in which you can look at it and say, well, look, the university's job is to provide people who have excellent technical skills who are prepared for the workforce, basically, and that we're not in the business of getting into other areas that are not about that. And so it's kind of an eye-opening thing.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today to preview the documentary.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
That's Steve Mims. He's a writer and a director of the documentary Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. It'll be shown next Wednesday and Thursday at the Wisconsin Film Festival. You can go to wifilmfest.org for a schedule.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today after 7, it's Snap Judgment, bringing us intriguing storytelling about the defining moments in people's lives. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, in 2010, the United States Supreme Court ruled in the case of Citizens United, a conservative political organization, versus the Federal Elections Commission.
Citizens United claimed that political spending was a form of free speech protected under the Constitution. In a 5-4 decision, the court sided with the group over the FEC.
Since then, the political battle over campaign contributions has reached a fever pitch, with presidential candidates this year calling for an overhaul of the campaign finance system.
One author, our next guest, says instituting change from the top down may be less effective overall, and that if people want to see a change to the Citizens United ruling, they should work from the grassroots level to effect that change. Those groups, he says, should look at playbooks from a couple of recent success stories, the National Rifle Association and the Marriage Equality Movement.
Here in Wisconsin, 11 communities approved ballot referendums opposing the Citizens United ruling in last week's elections. David Cole joins us now. He's an author and professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center, and his new book is called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start off with what some of the presidential candidates this year have said. Campaign finance reforms have been a hot topic this election season. Here's a sampling from Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton.
No nominee of mine will get that nomination unless he or she is prepared, when they get on the Supreme Court, to as soon as possible vote to overturn Citizens United.
I love the idea of campaign finance reform. And one of the things you should do is everybody should be known. If somebody gives $1 million or $2 million or $5 million, it should be known.
Let's remember, Citizens United, one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in our country's history, was actually a case about a right-wing attack on me and my campaign. A right-wing organization took aim at me and ended up damaging our entire democracy. So, yes, you're not going to find anybody more committed to aggressive campaign finance reform than me.
So, David, there you heard from three top candidates this year. What is it about campaign finance reform, and specifically Citizens United, that has been so resonant with voters and with politicians this season?
Well, I think it's a decision that is seen as sort of opening the floodgates to very rich individuals and very rich corporations to flood campaigns and drown out the voices of ordinary people and blind, really. It's a decision that was blind to the real risks that kind of money unleashed in political campaigns can cause to the legitimacy of our democratic process.
What kind of data do we have about how people, Democrats and Republicans, feel about that Citizens United ruling?
It is one of the most unpopular decisions the Supreme Court has ever issued. Polls typically find that about 80 to 85% of Americans think Citizens United was wrongly decided, and 70% of Republicans tend to think that Citizens United was wrongly decided, which is part of the reason that Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump are all in agreement that there's something wrong there.
Bernie Sanders in particular has made this a pillar of his campaign, looking to overturn that ruling. But how hard is it to get a Supreme Court ruling overturned?
It's not easy, but I think where you've got a substantial portion of the American public who already believe the decision is wrong, you've got sort of the roots of the change there. The court doesn't, historically, the court has not generally differed dramatically from where public opinion is. And so if campaign finance reform activists organize and engage strategically in a range of reform measures, I think principally at the state and local levels, I think we have a very good chance of seeing Citizens United radically cut back, if not overturned altogether, in our lifetimes.
So you're saying looking at the not necessarily the national level right at the Supreme Court, but you're talking about looking at the local level and starting there. Why start there instead of just trying to get the court to overturn it?
Right. Well, I say that largely because of what I found in working on my book, Engines of Liberty, which really examined the two most successful constitutional reform movements of the past 40 years, the marriage equality movement and the NRA's effort to get the individual right to bear arms recognized as a Second Amendment right. In both instances, those groups faced a court that would not, at the outset, have considered their claim legitimate. Marriage equality was unthinkable 20, 25 years ago, and the court had long held that the Second Amendment didn't protect an individual right to bear arms. So they didn't file lawsuits in federal court and try to convince the courts that somehow the Supreme Court got it wrong. What they did instead was start in the states, go to the states that were most sympathetic to them, and start there. So the gay rights group started in New England, the NRA started in Florida, develop state law reforms and state constitutional arguments in those states, then migrate those to, you know, slightly less sympathetic states, and only when they got sufficient momentum developed in the states did the argument jump the tracks and was it able to succeed at the federal level. And I think that is really the model for constitutional reform today.
We're talking with David Cole right now. He's an author and professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center, talking about Citizens United and campaign finance and looking at how David Cole says the way to go is to affect change to Citizens United at the grassroots level, local level. And in the model that you're talking about, David, are we looking at a Supreme Court who essentially mirrors the mood of the country?
In a way, yes. I mean, what I argue in the book is that the Supreme Court doesn't so much change constitutional law as recognize that it has changed. The Supreme Court in 1972 was presented with a case that said that gay couples should have the same right to marry as heterosexual couples, and it dismissed the argument in a single sentence, said it doesn't even raise a substantial legal question. We're not even going to address it on the merits. 2015, the court, actually probably a more conservative court than the court in 1972, facing the same arguments, no different arguments, recognized a constitutional right of same-sex couples to marry on the same terms as heterosexual couples. So what changed? The arguments didn't change before the court. The court didn't actually change in terms of getting more liberal. If anything, it was more conservative. But what changed was the ground underneath, the ground against which this argument was being considered. And how did that change? It changed through a variety of advocacy initiatives that gay rights groups did, which largely were focused at the state level, but also included public messaging and pressure on entertainment and radio and news and television news to present gay characters and individuals in a more positive light. It was the force of people working together through these organizations outside of the courts that made it possible for the argument, the exact same argument, which was rejected as completely insubstantial in 1972, to be successful in 2015.
You're talking about a model for creating constitutional law that I think advocates who want campaign finance reform would say that's going to take forever. If I start state by state, city by city, that's a years-long, maybe decades-long road compared with maybe just trying to overturn the case right at the Supreme Court's doors.
Yeah, it does take a long time. It takes what I call patient incrementalism, and that is the strategy that the marriage equality folks pursued. That is also the strategy that the NRA folks pursued, and they were ultimately successful in doing that. And the thing is that constitutional law is difficult to change. It doesn't change overnight. It doesn't change on a dime. It takes a sort of extended period of democratic engagement so that the legal and popular culture can shift in order for that constitutional change to be reflected in Supreme Court decisions. And that's how it's generally happened, and I think that is how it will happen here. But there, you know, the good news is that campaign finance reform groups already are doing this. They are advancing novel public financing schemes in a number of cities and states. They've been adopted that empower the small donors and provide substantial public financing to candidates who agree to limit their raising of money from large donors. They've also proposed and enacted transparency requirements that respond to this problem of secret and dark money, and those are, you know, that's the beginning of the movement that over time, if it gets adopted in a series of states, I think will then present an opportunity for the Supreme Court to reconsider its rationale in Citizens United.
And David, just briefly before we take callers, you also point to scholarship as being an important tool for people who might want to look at overturning Citizens United, that this is something that the National Rifle Association did very effectively.
That's right. When they started, really in the 1970s was when the NRA became a political organization focused on establishing this right. And at that time, the Legal Academy was in line with the courts in saying the Second Amendment protects only the state's rights to have militias and not individual rights to have guns. But the NRA supported scholars who took a different view. And by the time the case reached the Supreme Court in 2008, the majority of law review articles published took the view that indeed the Second Amendment does protect an individual right to bear arms, and a number of prominent liberal constitutional law scholars, including Larry Tribe at Harvard, had endorsed that view. So they changed the scholarship, and that, I think, made it easier for the court, which in fact cited some of that scholarship in its decision, to reach that point of view. And people are doing the same thing now with respect to campaign finance reform, challenging the empirical presumptions that the court relied upon, challenging some of the logic of some of the arguments that it has made, advancing new legitimate interests for regulating money in the campaign context, and all of that, I think, does contribute to creating the space for the court to recognize that constitutional law should change.
David Cole is our guest right now. He's an author and professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center. And he's with us to talk about how citizen activists and others can learn from the National Rifle Association and the marriage equality movement if they want to reverse the Supreme Court's ruling on Citizens United.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see that Citizens United ruling reversed, or do you think it's shifted the political landscape in the U.S.? There's no going back. There shouldn't be any going back. And were you involved in any of the local referenda in Wisconsin, either last week or over the years, that has passed local initiatives calling for a change in campaign finance laws? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about how our guest says citizen activists can affect constitutional law. We're looking at this topic through the lens of the 2009 Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that Citizens United ruling, of the way money works in American politics? Are you hoping for a change? Have you been active in efforts to make that change? Or do you want to make the case for the system as it is since that 2009 ruling? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
David Cole is with us now. His latest book is called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. And we'll go to our callers now. We have Matt on the line in Viroqua. Matt, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I remember the day that I read in the paper that Citizens United had passed and how upsetting that was. I was sitting in a lunch area at my school. I'm a full-time college student. And arguing against the logic that their justices used to support Citizens United doesn't seem like it should be terribly difficult, because saying that because somebody's more wealthy, and I tend to have capitalist ideas more than anything, that's not capitalism, it's corruption. Saying that someone's more wealthy, for that reason alone, they should have more say in our political system, it just doesn't jive. I'd like to see a law that says the more degrees somebody has, or, you know, the more scholarly articles they've read, they have more say in our political system, rather than because you made a bunch of money, you have more sway.
Man, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate that. And David, did any of the arguments he was making there get at some of the scholarship veins that people are looking at when they look at overturning Citizens United?
I think the central problem with Citizens United was that the court said the only legitimate interest the government has in regulating spending on campaigns is to avoid bribery and the appearance of bribery. And there is no other legitimate concern. So what one of the things scholars have done is to sort of point to alternative concerns, because if your only legitimate basis for regulating is bribery, then there are very limited restrictions. You can't restrict spending, because spending is not a bribe. A bribe is a contribution, not an expenditure. A number of scholars have argued that, you know, that just misses what is concerning about the expenditure of large amounts of money. One problem is that it creates an incentive for politicians and representatives to pay attention to some people, those who give and spend lots of money, far disproportionately to other people, those who don't have those kinds of resources. And our system is based on a theory that the representatives represent all of their constituents and not just the rich ones. So the interest in equalizing the distorting effects of money on the political campaign system is one that I think can be articulated as a common sense rationale, can be justified through a reference to precedents and the like, and I think ultimately could lead the court to be more open to a much more stringent regulation of spending in political campaigns. But that will come only if there's both scholarship and political pressure in a sufficiently wide swath of states and forums that the court feels the need to adjust or recognize that our constitutional law needs to be adjusted.
Well, thank you for that call, Matt. And we're going to go next to George in Madison. George, hello.
Hello there. Mr. Cole, you bring up some issues, or I guess some instances of resolutions being passed to change language. I didn't hear, and maybe I missed it, the full discussion of the 700 communities in Wisconsin that have passed the United to Amend and Move to Amend resolutions, 72 in Wisconsin of those 700, of which 11 were last Tuesday. That is the movement. That's going to be all it is, changing the language. It's not going to do anything. And I didn't hear you bring up the biggest movement that is out there.
So that's a great question. That's a great question. So that the movement that you're referring to is the movement to put out a call and support through local ballot initiatives an effort to amend the Constitution, to overturn Citizens United through the formal amendment process. I think that's a terribly important organizing tool. It allows for this issue to be raised at the local level in all parts of the country, and I think it's very important for that purpose. I don't think it will lead to an amendment of the Constitution. It is remarkably difficult to amend the Constitution. The Constitution has been amended in the formal way. It's been amended only 27 times. The first 10 were in the Bill of Rights, and that was sort of part of the initial bargain, so really only 17 times since then. The last amendment to pass was the 27th Amendment. All it did was say that when members of Congress vote themselves a raise, they can't get the raise. It has to go to the people who come in after them. That passed in the 1980s. It was first introduced and proposed in something like 1790. It took almost 200 years to pass. It's very, very difficult to amend the Constitution in that way. So, yes, that's an important political organizing tool, but that's, I think, not likely to be the way in the end that this constitutional law gets changed.
And, Dave, we have just a couple of seconds left here, but do you think that with Antonin Scalia gone from the court, one of the most vocal conservative voices, that this swings the balance at all?
Oh, absolutely. And the justice who replaces Justice Scalia and any new justices that are appointed by the next president, given that three of the justices will be 80 or over during the next president's tenure, will obviously play a critical role. And they're being put on the court at a time when there is very broad concern about this case makes it more likely that we will succeed in cutting back on or overturning Citizens United.
David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
David Cole is an author and professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center. His most recent book is called Engines of Liberty.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our guest reporter takes stock of the on-the-ground impact of recent budget cuts for the UW system.
And we check out the history of psychedelics in America, from rock and roll's Deadheads to internet pioneers.
All that and look at the latest news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 7, Joy and her guests go out on the campaign trail to figure out what younger voters want from presidential candidates. That's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next is the news from NPR and WPR, and then political analyst Harry Enten from 538.com joins us to talk about the ongoing search for a presidential nominee for both parties. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.